Good afternoon, everybody. April 15th. I'm really pleased to introduce our speaker for this month. Bodie grew up in Marshall, Texas, went off to the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, and then after that, spent 3 years on the USS Boone out of Florida. That is a, in case you're wondering, a guided missile frigate. Spent some time in the North Red Sea, where they were boarding other vessels and doing cool Navy stuff. He's moved back to Dallas, and he and his wife, Laura, they have three boys, Jack, Ben, and Mark. You know, he's actually written several books. I'm going to let him tell you a little bit more about those today, but let's all put our hands together and make a big, warm welcome for Bodie Spengler.
Thank you, Sebastian. I appreciate that introduction. I appreciate the opportunity to come speak to this group. You know that anytime you're asked your opinion, it is encouraging. And so y'all have encouraged me today just by having me here, and I appreciate that. And I hope that you leave here today encouraged to the same degree that you've encouraged me. You know, it's been 5 years, Bill, since I have spoken, I think, at a Father's Forum like this, affiliated with Abiding Fathers. And the last time I was here 5 years ago, our oldest son, Jack, was a sophomore, and we had a junior high and a elementary school student. And we still have those three sons, but they are now in college and about to graduate from high school and a sophomore in high school. Our second son's about to graduate, and that's just blowing my mind. I can't believe that has gotten here so quickly. I can't believe he's gone from here to here so fast. If you've ever gone through anything like that, I know many of you have, with high school graduates, marriages, grandchildren, it just absolutely blows your mind how quickly it gets here. And I remember when our boys were young guys, all under the age of 10, and we're running around chasing them everywhere, and older parents, way, way older than I was at the time, said, remember, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And I would just like to sit those parents down now and ask them, if it's not a sprint, how did it go by so quickly? I'm looking up to all three of them. And as Ben's graduation approaches, just like it was with Jack, our oldest, I have this overwhelming desire to sit down with him one more time and have one final conversation with him about all those things that we've talked about over the years. Of course, I realize it doesn't work like that. You don't get to sit down and have one final conversation. That conversation started the day Ben was born, and it will end the day he leaves our home to go to college. This stage is over. Of course, I hope our relationship continues. I believe it will. It's a good one. It's healthy, thank God. But it's going to change. And if you've been there, you know that. It changes. And it's pretty sobering. It's pretty sobering, but it's also very exciting. So as all this sinks in for me for the second time now, I'm reminded of a guy that I have read a lot of named Jonathan Sacks. I don't know if any of y'all have read any of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks's words, but I want you to listen very closely to this one. This is a deep, deep one. Here it is. To defend a land, you need an army. But to defend freedom, you need education. You need parents, families, homes and schools, and a constant conversation between the generations to see that your ideas are passed on to the next generation and never lost. You achieve immortality not by building pyramids or statues, but by engraving your values on the hearts of your children and they on theirs, so that our ancestors live on in us and we in our children, and so on until the end of time. Does that sound familiar to any of you? Do those words sound familiar? Remember, this is a rabbi, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. So when I hear that, When I read that for the first time, it sounded familiar to me. And my mind immediately went back to the Old Testament. And you probably know where I'm going with this, to Deuteronomy. Moses is giving his farewell address to God's people. If you recall, Moses is not going to be allowed to go into the promised land because he disobeyed God. But he does have this opportunity to address God's people one final time. It's in Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9, and this is what he says. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, and with all your strength. These commands that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit down and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them on your wrists. Bind them on your foreheads. Nail them to your city gates and to the door frames of your homes. In other words, what he's saying is this is not a sometime thing. This is an all-the-time thing. These are not just words. They're actions. Sit, walk, bind, nail. And when I read that, when I read those words, and I've read them a bunch. I've read them many times over the years. And I can read them. I can comprehend them. But I begin to wonder, what does that look like in a real flesh and blood father? Because Moses is talking to fathers here in his farewell address. That's who he is addressing. And I wonder, what does that look like? I know what the words are, but what does a man who's living that out, a fallible, imperfect father like me, what does that look like? And I think I know. 1990 was a watershed year for me. There were two events that took place in my life that year, and I would say that they were equal in magnitude, yet completely opposite in nature. In May of that year, I graduated from the United States Naval Academy. And graduation was amazing. The week leading up to graduation, we called it June Week, was fantastic. There were parties between every meal, meals between every party, and it was leading up to the day of. And I remember graduation very vividly. It could have been yesterday. We were at Navy Marine Corps Memorial Stadium with 1,000 other classmates. I was sitting there in the field. The stands were full. My family was there. All my friends who could attend were there. The Blue Angels flew over. The Vice President of the United States landed in Air Force Two. He addressed our class. We took the oath of office and were sworn in as officers in the United States Navy and some of my classmates into the Marine Corps. We threw our hats in the air like you see on TV. It was just fantastic. My favorite picture from that day is of my father and me on the 50-yard line after graduation. He is dressed in his favorite suit and his favorite tie. I'm in my choker whites, gold buttons, shoulder boards, combination cover. I'm tan and looking good. There are two reasons I love that picture. The first is when I look at it and I see my father smiling, I know that I pleased my father on that day. Now, I don't want you to get me wrong. My father told my sister, I have one sibling, told my sister and me throughout our lives that we were a joy to him and that we pleased him and that we pleased my mother. But on that day, it was particularly meaningful. The second reason I love that picture so much is it reminds me that that week, for my family and especially for my father and especially that day, was my farewell gift to him. About 5 months later, I was at the Surface Warfare School in Newport, Rhode Island. And I was coming back from studying one night in late November after Thanksgiving. I remember it was incredibly cold. It was snowing. It was probably about 11 o'clock at night. And I got to my apartment there on Lower Thames Street. And as soon as I walked in, my Annapolis classmate and my roommate there in Newport, Dennis Thomas, said, "Bodie, your mother called." I remember saying, "Well, it's late. I'll call her tomorrow." He said, "No, you need to call her tonight." And I could tell by the tone of his voice that something wasn't right. And I looked at the note that he had taken from my mom. It was my grandmother's number. I thought that was odd, and why my mom had not left our number. And I called my grandmother's number, and before I could process the rest of what was happening, a friend answered, got my mom on the phone, and my mom said, "Bodie, I don't know how to tell you this, but your father has gone to be with the Lord." My dad was 49 years old. He had dropped dead on the tennis court playing doubles with three of his friends. And I remember when my mom told me that, the blood ran out of my face. I was numb. I remember being very angry at one point, shocked. And if you had asked me from that moment for the next 2 or 3 years, "Bodie, what is it that has had the greatest impact on your life?" I would have told you without hesitation it was my father's death. But by God's grace, from about 3 years after that to today, if you said, "Bodie, what is it that's had the greatest impact on your life?" I would tell you, with the exception of Jesus Christ himself, it was not my father's death, but his life and the lessons therein that had and continue to have the greatest impact on me. Now, before I go any further, I want to say something. I know you're filtering every single thing I say through your own experience with your own father, and perhaps through your own experience with your own children. But what I don't know is what that experience is, what it was. I don't know. But if the numbers are right, and I believe they are, then there's probably some hurt and some pain in this room today. But there is also, thankfully, a remedy for that pain and that hurt. When my dad died, I was hurt. I was scared. I remember thinking, well, that's it. If I'm going to die when I'm 49, then let's go. Let's go. I just remember thinking the same thing was going to happen to me. And I began to make decisions based on my fear of that happening. And I made some bad decisions. And I didn't make my decisions on the promises of God. But by God's grace, he flipped the switch, and I'm so glad he did. And I just want to say this. This is what I've learned. Whatever it is that scares you, whatever it is that hurts you, even if that hurt is from your own father or from your own children, God is bigger than your fear, and he is bigger than your hurt. And he can heal you, and he can make you whole. I know this because God did it for me. And if he did it for me, he can do it for you. 2 days after my father died, my mother and my sister and I walked into the bank to open that safety deposit drawer that you hope you never have to open early. And when we opened it, we found what you would expect to find. We found a will, insurance papers, a couple of deeds. But on top of everything, we found a treasure for all time. We found a handwritten letter from my father that had been updated over time. And it said, "Dear Bonnie, Bodie, and Claire, if you're reading this, that must mean I'm not here anymore." Now, I'm sure my father anticipated us reading that letter when he was 99 and not 49, but that was not to be. And he opened the letter with a section for my mom, encouraging her in what he knew would be a difficult time should it ever come to pass. And then he turned his attention to my sister, my younger sister, and me. And he said, "Bodie and Claire, I want to tell you how pleased I am with the adults you've become." And he's talked about some of the successes, recent successes in our life. And then he said, "I want to remind you that I'm your father and I love you." And he talked about that. And he closed the letter with a section for Claire and a section for me, and they were very similar. And they both said, "God has a special plan for your life." And in my section, it said, "Your Annapolis education will serve you well for the rest of your life." You see, what my dad was doing one final time was telling us what he had told us always throughout our lives, that he was for us, that no matter what happened in the world, even if the whole world was against us, our Father was for us. "I'm pleased with you, I love you, I'm for you, and God has a special plan for your life. You know, had that letter been all that there was, I don't know that it would have meant as much. It probably would have meant a great deal. But my father, from the day we were born until the day he died, lived out every single thing he wrote in that letter. The first thing he said was that I am pleased with you. I can't tell you how many times my dad told me that. I can't tell you how many times I heard him tell my sister that. But I remember one time in particular. I was about 12 years old, and my dad and I had just wrapped up my Little League baseball game. I was playing on the White Sox, and my dad was the assistant coach. John Whalen, his friend, was the head coach. Funny how you remember little things like that. And we had finished our game. I don't remember if we won or lost, but I remember what we did next because we always did the same thing. We walked across the street to the big baseball park to watch the high schoolers play. And I always loved doing that because it was, I got to watch my heroes. I want to be like those guys one day. And I was hanging on the fence, watching, probably eating a corn dog and eating some fries that we got at the concession stand. And my dad was a few feet down from me. And a friend of his came up to him and said, "Martin, how are you doing?" I guess they hadn't seen each other in a while. They gave each other a big hug, and he said, "How are Bodie and Claire?" Obviously not seeing me down the way, or he would have just asked, "How you doing?" "How are Bodie and Claire?" I'll never forget what my dad said. He said, "They're doing great. They are such a joy to their mother and me, and we are so pleased with them." And I remember hanging on that fence and poking my chest out just a little further and standing just a little taller because I knew that I had pleased my father. That was 42 years ago. And you can tell, I can't tell the story without crying. It meant everything to me to know that I'd pleased him, and it made me want to please him more. The second thing my father wrote in that letter was, "I love you. I'm your father, and I love you." When my mother was 7 months pregnant with me, remember, I'm the oldest, my dad came running in the house one day after work, and he ran up to my mom and he said, "Bonnie, I've made a decision." You'd have to know my dad, but I promise you that's what he did. And my mom said, "Well, what is it?" He said, "I'm going to tell my children, coming and going, that I love them, and I'm going to kiss them, and I'm going to hug them, coming and going." And my mom said, "Fine." And my dad said, "Fine then." And so that's what he did for the rest of his life. Every morning, a hug and a kiss, and "I love you." Every time he saw us at the end of the day, the same thing. When he left for a trip, when he returned from a trip, "I love you," and a kiss and a hug. I used to think it was no big deal that my father told me that he loved me. But when I was about 10, a friend of mine's father, a good friend of my father's, was killed in a car wreck. And I remember we went over to my friend's house that night. And for some reason, it was just the three of us in a room, my dad, my friend, and me. And I was sitting on the couch, and I remember my friend standing in front of my father. And of everything he could have asked him, he had one question. He said, "Mr. Spangler, why did my father never tell me that he loved me?" Now, my dad's response was as good as it could have been that day. He said, "Son, I don't know why he didn't tell you that, but I know he did. I know your dad loved you very much. You make sure when you grow up and have kids of your own that you tell your children that you love them." And I'll tell you, my friend today, every time he sees his kids, "I love you," and a kiss and a hug. I'll say this about that. I don't know where you are with your kids, but it is never too late. And your children are never, ever too old to hear from their father that you love them. The third thing my father wrote in that letter, or that he implied, and he certainly said many, many times, was that he was in my corner, that he was for me, that no matter what, he was for me. I started wrestling when I was 5 years old. Crazy, huh? Not the Saturday night wrestling. The collegiate style wrestling. And Started wrestling when I was 5 years old. By the time I was 15, I'd won the state championship in Texas twice, and I'd placed third in the Tulsa Junior Nationals. My dad was a wrestler at Vanderbilt, so I come about that honestly. But before those victories and those state championships, it was some tough stuff and a lot of losses. And there's this one wrestler named Jimmy Everman that just kicked my tail every time we wrestled, and I wrestled him a lot, it turned out. And I was coming off the mat after one of those matches with Jimmy Everman. That's not his real name, by the way. I changed it a long time ago just in case he was ever in the audience. But I was coming off the mat. And Jimmy had kicked my tail again, rubbed my face all in the mat. And my dad was an assistant coach. And I came off the mat and he said, you don't think you can beat Everman, do you? And I said, no, I don't. I don't think I can. He said, well, I think you can. And I'm going to show you how. And so for the next 2 months in practice, my father would have me wrestle bigger, older, stronger wrestlers than me. And at first, that didn't go well. But after several practices, I started to hold my own. And after a month or two, I started to beat these guys, these bigger, older, stronger guys. And I began to believe in my mind that if I was given a chance to wrestle Everman again, I was going to win. And as fate would have it, in the last tournament of the season before the state championships, it was Everman versus Spangler in the finals. And I was ready. Now, I want to tell you something about Everman that you need to know for this story. Everman, if he was ever in danger in a match, if he was ever in danger of losing or getting pinned, he would fake an injury. And the referee would inevitably stop the match and make sure he was okay, and he always was. But it would give him enough time to regroup, and he would usually go on to win. Well, my father knew this. Everybody knew this about this guy. And my dad talked to the referee before, and the referee said, don't worry, I will not let that happen. Going into the third round, late in the third round, with about 30 seconds to go, it was Everman 8, Spangler 6. If you hadn't ever wrestled before, there's three rounds. This was it, 30 seconds. But I felt good. I was on top, and I got a hold on him like a vice grip. And I started to turn him, and I got him flat on his back. But as soon as his shoulders hit the mat, he let out a squeal and a scream like a schoolgirl. And the referee stopped the match. My dad was running onto the mat. No, don't stop it. Too late. He stopped the match. Everman was, of course, okay, miraculously. When he restarted the match, there was barely 10 seconds left. I'm on top, Everman stalled, match is over, I lose 8-6, and just devastated. So I'm on the platform for the trophy ceremony. Second place position, I'm given my trophy, the ceremony's going on, I'm starting to cry. I mean, it was devastating. I'd worked a long time to beat Everman, and I had beat him, and dadgummit. So I come off the stands with my trophy, and my dad says, come here. We go around kind of behind the bleachers, and he gets down on one knee. He takes a pen from his pocket and says, let me see your trophy. I hand it to him. He turns the trophy over, and on the bottom of the marble base, he wrote this, judges score, Everman 8, Spangler 6. My score, Everman 8, Spangler 9. Put the trophy down, put the pen in his pocket, and he said, son, I don't care what the judges said. You won today. You beat Everman. You are a winner. The fourth and final thing my father wrote in that letter was that God has a plan for your life. Your Annapolis education will serve you well for the rest of your life. I applied to Annapolis right out of high school. It's a long story, but I was sent a letter that had an administrative error in it. I was sent the wrong letter saying I hadn't gotten in, so I didn't go. And I that's another story, but I'll tell you, at the time, I was relieved. I wound up going to University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, joining a fraternity, and living the life and doing a lot of things my mom and dad probably wouldn't have been proud of. About November, we got a call from the Naval Academy explaining the administrative error, and the door was opened again for me to reapply to Annapolis. And I knew that was God. I knew that was God. I was doing a lot of stuff I wasn't supposed to be doing, but I knew that was God. In spite of that, I went home for Thanksgiving, and I sat my mother and father down, and I explained to them very eloquently why I wanted to stay at North Carolina and keep doing what I was doing. And to his credit, my father listened to the whole explanation, and he didn't interrupt me. And when I was done, though, he changed my life forever. He said, "Son, I hear you, but I know you. I know what makes you tick, and I know what makes you go. And if I could take my eyes out," I remember him saying that, "if I could take my eyes out and let you see what I see and let you know what I know about you, there is no doubt in my mind that you would go to Annapolis." And once again, I'm in tears. I'm scared, but I know he's right. You see, my father had broken my will, but he had set me free to pursue what he knew I should pursue. And I'm not saying Annapolis is for everybody. It's not. But it was the right place for me, and my father knew it. And because my father had the courage to tell me something I needed to hear when I needed to hear it at just the right time, I did go to Annapolis. I did graduate, and yep, a few months after that, my dad died, and we read that letter. "I'm pleased with you. I love you. I'm for you, and God has a plan for your life." And I'm going to tell you, in closing, that letter was a great gift. It was, but it was not my father's greatest gift. My father's greatest gift to me and to my sister was the way he reflected God's love to us, the love of the Heavenly Father to us. You see, because my earthly father told me that he loved me, I believe that God did too. Because my earthly father told me that he was pleased with me, I believe that God was too. Because my earthly father told me that he was for me, I believed that God was too. And because my earthly father told me that God had a plan for my life, I believed him. So how does a constant conversation look like? What does Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9 look like in a living, breathing, fallible, imperfect father? I think I know. And I hope now that you do too. Thank you so much.